Welcome back to the Discovering Forestry podcast. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Corey, alongside our friend, Mr. Arbor Joe Aitken, here for another compelling conversation about trees. Joe, fun time of year. Things are starting to swell. Sun comes up, snow's 53 inches, sun comes out again. Man, I love it. How about you? How are things going for you?
Things are still a little tight up here in the Midwest. You know, I like this time of the year. First quarter ends, second quarter begins, but there's a lull right there where everybody's kind of itching. And I took my son to a soccer game. He got to sub in. He's 10 years old, and he got to sub in a 14U soccer game. It held his own. But on my way out, we had 6 inches of snow on the ground. I seen a lawn applicating company had their flyer that they applied already. And I started laughing, and I'm thinking, all right, well, the only thing they had going is that I don't think that there's any frost in the ground. So I'm like, all right. And maybe they got it down before the snow, or maybe they applied with a snowmobile. I don't know. But this is an important time of the season when you're calibrating, you're getting ready to start your season, your spring season. And there's got to be a lot of things we have to think about. And I think safety is number one. You know, and it's not just safety for yourself. It's safety for the environment. So I think what's kind of exciting is our guest tonight, that's right in his wheelhouse. So I think this is a perfect time to talk about. And I think what we talk about today, when we talk about safety, I think we stretch disciplines from turf to trees to veg management to forestry. There's a lot of categories that overlap that I think our discussion tonight is going to cover. So I'm excited.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. And I think safety is something that obviously I've come up, or I'm still coming up in the industry, in the tree world, but it's been at the tip of the conversation for at least the last 6-8 years. People have been really hounding it in at different trade shows, speaking engagements, things like that. So I'm excited for tonight's guest, and I'm excited to see where the conversation takes us as well, because we could all do a better job at being safer. So, Joe, since you know this evening's guest longer than I have, I'll let you do the honors of bringing him on.
Yeah, our guest tonight, we've chatted quite a bit. We've been back and forth on social and bumped into each other, and we'll probably we're going to bump into each other again in an event next week. But our guest tonight is Tim Walsh. Tim, welcome to the podcast.
Good evening, Joe and Corey. Glad to be here. Was worth waiting for, and I'm excited to see where the conversation goes tonight. And to your discussion about this time of year, when I moved to Northeast Ohio, I was told by my mentor who brought me here, he said, it's never spring in Northeast Ohio until you see snow on the daffodils. And we've had that. So it's officially spring in Ohio.
Officially spring. The daffodils aren't growing, but you're Northeast, so I'm probably, so Northeast by Cleveland area?
We're South, but kind of Akron is the easiest place, sort of Hall of Fame, NFL Hall of Fame, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Canton.
Yep. Portage Lakes.
Perfect. Well, welcome to the show. And I'm glad that we're on, because I think it's time of the year when we need to remind the industry. And when I said the topic stretches from discipline to discipline, it truly does. So why don't you fill us in a little bit on yourself, how you got in the business, what you're doing now, and what's the future hold for Tim Walsh in the green industry?
Wow. Is this podcast 8 hours long, or how much time do we have?
We'll get you.
We'll cut it down.
Yeah, no, thanks. I feel very fortunate to have the opportunities that I've had. I started a small residential tree company in northern Wisconsin in the 80s, kind of dating myself there a little bit, but it was one of those owner, operator, sales rep, business person, crew leader, and myself was kind of the company. And that kind of got me interested in the industry. I've been fortunate to work for a bunch of great organizations through my career, and found an interest in and seemed to be fairly good at training and teaching, which, you know, kind of shifted things a little bit. I got involved with the ISA in the 90s and eventually ended up being staff arborist for then the National Arborist Association, now the Tree Care Industry Association. Moved from the upper Midwest to the Northeast, spent some time there. And then this is the next sentence. I'm the only person that will ever be able to say this on the planet without lying. I was the safety director, interim safety director for the Lucas Tree Expert Company, the safety director for the Asplund Tree Expert Company, the vice president of health and safety for the Davie Tree Expert Company, and now the vice president of safety and training for the Townsend Company.
Wow.
Again, somebody else could say those words, but they would be lying.
That's a lot of safety.
It is.
Now, I want to back up. First of all, you said you kind of got in there, you know, chief bottle washer. You did everything. But one step back, why trees?
That's a great question. I actually grew up in Chicago. So, you know, there was they have a great forestry program. Kind of grew up around trees, which, you know, an interest in them in the city. But it really wasn't until we started vacationing in North Wisconsin, which we ended up moving there. And I graduated high school in Minocqua, Wisconsin. So spent my summers and winters in and around the trees. And just sort of the pun I use is I fell into tree work. Now, it's interesting that I'm dealing with safety in tree work, but falls is one of the number one killers. Was working at a job after high school, wanted to go to college. At the time, making $6 an hour at a grocery store, knew that wasn't going to pay for school. And it's somebody I worked with, her fiance at the time worked for the local tree company and was going to leave, and said I should go and talk to the owner of the company. And that's how it started. Enjoyed it, loved every aspect of it. Then I did that for a couple of years. And realized that after one day I had my eyes freeze open and another day one eye freeze shut while I was working, I thought, I don't want to have to do this for the rest of my life. So it really pushed me to go to school. And as it turns out, 30 plus years later, I'm still doing it. Shifted to school, went to UW Stevens Point, doubled there undergrad, went right off to my master's at Stevens Point, and continued on, and I'm actually still in school. My friends call me the perpetual student, but a friend signed a book that he wrote and said, the truly educated never graduate. So that's what I'm going with.
Oh, another great quote.
Man.
Pat Rothfuss is the author. The Name of the Wind is the series. An author from Stevens Point, Wisconsin.
Go Point, Joe. I just got to say, go Point.
Go ahead. Yo.
Yeah.
I'm a Sparty, but hey, I just want you to know, Tim, that it's you said 30 plus. I think it might be 40 plus, isn't it?
Yeah, math are hard.
I just want to let everybody know that the years of experience that we both have in this industry is, it's extensive. So you mentioned a bunch of phenomenal companies. It had to have been exciting to be able to work on safety programs within the, you know, you're talking big international companies. We're not talking about mom and pop shops. But what I think what's important to understand is that the protocol that's developed by these big companies is what is used by the industry as a standard. You know, and then the companies that you mentioned, you know, even Townsend, they get an opportunity to work on ANSI standards that is industry wide. So that had to have been pretty exciting to be in a position to potentially change the way the industry views safety, because safety obviously is probably the number one thing that we should be talking about on a day-to-day basis.
It really is. And I've been fortunate there. I've been involved with the ANSI Z133 committee since the 2000 revision, sat at the table, represented different organizations. But I'm glad you said that, because the big companies spend a lot of time and resources helping the industry. And we, a lot of the big companies give back in a variety of different ways. And, you know, the company I started with three or four people, we actually never went to a conference. They, you know, they just didn't have the resources to do that. And these other companies spend a lot of time and believe in stewardship to the industry. So it's great to be part of that, you know, along with the other organizations. And one of the things, I see the logo, I'm the past president of Utility Arbor Association. So there's a lot of good that's being done by a lot of different companies, different organizations. So it's great to be a part of all of that.
Well, let's talk about that. So, you know, a lot of people, everybody has a choice on what industry they're going to work for. And I think a lot of people that are drawn to the tree realm for various reasons, you're going to find those companies, like you were discussing earlier, that have that culture of safety. So the companies that you were talking about, very big, very well known, very good track record when you consider the number of employees because of programs like yours. Where do you start? How do you, if somebody brings you in, where do you start? How do you develop that culture and that mentality of safety in the workplace?
Great question, Corey. If we could answer that, none of us would have to work again, because we'd be paying us millions of dollars an hour. Culture is an interesting thing, and this is one we could definitely talk a lot about. And we use the phrase safety culture all the time. And one of my talks, I put that up and I kind of define it. And then I put the circle with the line through it, because you can't have safety culture separate from your company culture. You can't be a safe company and then be an unethical one, or, you know, so it's all about the culture, and it's finding the right fit. And so, you know, a lot of folks like myself have worked for different companies. They're all good, but it's you've got to find the one that matches your culture. And it's tough. Like you said, you compare the first company I was with to a company with, you know, 20,000 employees. It's easier to influence the culture when you see every employee every single day, as opposed to you write a policy and you email it out and you hope somebody reads it and understands it. So culture is tough, because it's everything we do. You think about it. You know, Joe said you're a Sparty. My sister-in-law is a Sparty. You know, we identify ourselves based on our sports teams. And I use the analogy, and I'll turn some people off by saying the sex thing, but I grew up in Chicago, great sports town, like a lot of cities. So that's my sports culture. As I moved around the globe, I adopted, air quotes, adopted the teams that were local, because you kind of had to. That's the people you knew. And I would root for, you know, the Patriots when I lived in New England, or, you know, the Phillies when I lived in Philadelphia. But when Chicago came to town, that's my culture. And so, you know, I do these talks, and I try to rile people up a little bit on this to get them thinking, because if I'm a Chicago fan and I live in New England, I might act like a New Englander, but I'm still from Chicago. And so if you don't have the right culture, you might act like you do, but when the pressure is on, you're going to revert to your old culture. And that's the struggle. So that's why you really have to match your personal culture with the organization you're with. And flip side, as you're hiring and firing people, you need to make sure that they match your culture.
I'm going to throw some gas on everything. I'm going to turn the heat up, and I'm going to, because this has been something I've asked in the past to other guests. I don't know if I've ever really got an answer that I can say that, okay. And I'm going to start off is that you're right. Culture is something that you can breed, and you can massage within a location. But I think what's happening, and I might get shot at, I might have an arrow in my back, but I think culture is equivalent to cost, is equivalent to investing in the industry. So I was curious as to, when we look at statistics and safety, and you've probably seen all kinds of reports, TCI, a magazine has the chapter in the back talks about injuries across the industry and deaths. Is there a percentage of injuries versus attending these seminars versus not? And what I'm saying is that, yeah, we got culture. Culture costs money, because you're going to have to pay to have somebody come do it. If it's this important, why can't we get the industry to offer up free educational services that are not involved and don't have the opportunity to come breathe some of this culture? Am I making sense or am I blabbing?
No, you are. I don't think you'll get shot, not by me anyway, because you had a couple of questions kind of rolled in there. So yeah. I think on the front side of it, there's data to support at the organizational level. The more training that an organization provides, the fewer severe incidents that organization tends to have. And that goes back 15, 20, 25 years with TCIA and others. So at that level, the more training we do, the safer we are as an organization. So then the next piece is, how do you get that training? So an organization like Townsend or Asplund or Lewis or whoever, they've got resources to do. They have training departments. You know, that company I started with three people, the training, I learned how to tie bowline when my foreman came up face to face, looked me in the eye, and one hand tied the bowline on his snap and walked away. That was my training. And so it depends on the organization. The next piece, and this is where I'll probably get shot, is, you know, we get into discussions around the Z133 standard, and I'll pin there for a second on the price. But people complain that if it's a safety standard, why isn't it free? Conceptually, makes sense, right? It's a safety standard. Why isn't it free? So there's actually two pins. I'll pull one of the pins. Is the safety standard is about $15. People are climbing with $800 saddles and $900 pants, and they wouldn't spend the $15 on the safety standard. So that argument doesn't hold up with me. The second pin, and I don't know if you've heard the ISA, if you heard Caitlin talk, ISA plans to provide the new Z133, the 2024 revision, for free in some format that people can get. So the other piece of that, the second part of that first pin is, OSHA standards have been free since they were created in 1970 by the OSHA Act. People aren't following those either. So it's not enough. You know, it's the horse and water thing. The standards are there. They're not being followed. ANSI standards are more specifically written to our industry, and it makes more sense to pay more attention to them. But even with that, if we hand those to people, are they necessarily going to be safer? And to your original point, Joe, if we're doing all this, are we going to see cultural change? And I think we are. And I think we're seeing it. And, you know, in our decades, plural, between us, we've seen changes. And Corey, in your time, I bet you've seen it too.
Yeah, and that's interesting and so curious to hear. So Joe and I work a couple hundred companies that we're exposed to annually. And I could back up your statement on those companies that have safety as a training, safety is in the forefront of what they do as part of their culture. They're doing a good job in other places too. So there should be something said to that. And I'm wondering, Tim, in all of your travels and all the work you've done on this, when things go wrong and it gets reported, you know, somebody fills out the paperwork, do you think it's because companies or individuals are cutting corners, trying to make money, just don't know, or some other reason? Why do you think safety fails or our training
there's
fails?
It's a complex issue. And so what I'll do is our industry is Joe was saying, there's all these different aspects of what we do, right? We, you know, there's line clearance, there's UVM, there's all different things. But let me shift to make the discussion easier on the utility sector. So the companies that trim trees for or on behalf of the organizations that maintain power lines. So these are the folks that fall under 29 CFR 1910 269, the line clearance stuff. So part of the pressure comes from the regulator, from OSHA. So there's a couple of things that OSHA looks at. They want to, and I love the way you phrase that, Corey, about an injury happened and it is reported, because they're not all reported and there's pressures there. So it starts with OSHA making sure that people are counting injuries, because they want to see that information. And recently they've started publicizing it for different reasons, and we won't get into that too much. But the other thing, so they value that number. So they make that important. And then another thing that they look at is punishment. if a company is cited, they look, the company has a chance of beating a citation if you can basically show a couple of things. You had a policy in place that would have prevented the injury. It was communicated to the employee in a manner in which they can comprehend, which means if you don't read English and I hand you an English tailgate, that doesn't count. You have to have a process by which supervision sees how work is done in the field, and you have to have an escalating disciplinary policy. So I've been in a room with OSHA where they have said, if you don't write Corey up for his violation, I'm going to cite the company. It's going to cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you're going to lose the ability to bid on work. So guess what we do? We write the person up. So then in the utility sector, the utilities have that pressure from the regulator. They're told to count injuries. They want to see punishment. They'll kick people off. So then that flows down to the contractors. And so that breeds opportunities for people to look at, do I report this or not? And I'll flip it a little more positive. Let's say the three of us work for a company and we've gone 10,000 days, work days without an incident. 10,000 work days. That's like 40 years of work. And today's Corey's first day, and he cuts himself on some barbed wire and he's going to require a stitch. He's going to blow 10,000 work days of a record. Do you think there's internal pressure on Corey to not report that? Do you think there's external pressure from the team that's going to take Corey out behind the shed afterwards and say you ruined that record? So all of these things come into play on safety. And so what happens with this piece of Corey's going to hide that incident, then we don't learn about the incident and we don't learn about these other things. And it's not the barbed wire, although that's a bad thing, or the poison ivy. It's the fall from tree, the struck by, the electrical contact, the serious incidents and fatalities. So all of that pressure hides incidents and we don't learn about them. So they keep happening. That's why I said, how many hours do we have here? You ask me a question, I go for it.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, you know, it's not funny, but it's interesting that there's a few things that you really can't hide, like a fall, a serious accident. But you're right. It could be all the little things. It could be the nicks. It could be the scrapes. It could be the sprained ankles. It could be, you know, but there's it's an inherent danger that obviously working around trees is probably one of the most dangerous occupations you could possibly have. So there's where the balance is. You know, you're putting yourself out there. And we've had guests on before and it talks about, now, you know, Tim, think about when we got into it. There was a company that I started with in the late 80s that I was green as green could be. And they stopped by the party store on the way out and they put a case of beer behind the front seat of the tower. And I think they had a six pack before they got to the first job. You know, and obviously, I don't know if that still happens because since I left that company, everybody else I worked for has been very professional. But at that time, that culture was not being exposed to safety. And I'm sure there's probably a lot more that goes on in this industry that we'll never know. But how do you fix it if we don't? I don't know. It's...
And that's the point, right? If you don't know what's out there. And I think about that too, or like I said, we started kind of the same time frame. And, you know, part of it's just, I look at it as a maturation of not only the industry, but companies. So, you know, the company I just worked for was 144-year history. I know you had Matt Fredmonski on a little bit back. Matt's a great guy. So they've been through a lot and they've gotten better because of it. Sometimes because, you know, things happen and sometimes it was proactive. But the company I started with, the only time anyone wore safety glasses, there was a box of safety glasses on the shelf covered in dust. And only after one summer, two employees were sprayed in the eyes with hydraulic fluid, did anyone think to break them out. And so, that, you know, you learn the hard way. And that's where I think some of the industry things at UAA and ISA, UCFS, and Leslie was on a little bit ago, TCA, we're all trying to help that small company learn the lesson without the pain of the lesson.
I think it's exciting to know, and I did hear Caitlin talk about ISA going to find a way to make the ANSI standards available at no charge. But that's wonderful and all, but that message will not make it to the people that need it. I think that 98%, 99% of the people that listen to podcasts like ours or others or attend conferences, they already got it. I think it's the other ones. And this has been on other podcasts. How do we reach the unreachable? Because that's the one that changes the industry and changes the statistic for us.
Yeah, that's always been the struggle, because those of us, you know, we talk at each other at every conference, right? Okay, this week Joe's talking to me about safety. Next week I'm talking to Joe about safety. Next week it's Corey. It's that company that I started at that never went to any conferences, that didn't know any of this stuff existed. And then even if you did hand them the Z133 and explain it to them, and that's the thing, when John Ball and I did that series of grants from the ISA that created that training program, we would present to people that worked for, consulting training companies that didn't understand the standard and they were training on it. It's terrifying. I'd rather them not know about the standard than have somebody acting as an expert telling them how to do it wrong.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Wow. Yeah, that definitely goes on. I mean, we see that Joe and I are, you know, a little bit more on the product pesticide side of things, but we still see that going on. And that is terrifying.
Well, it's tough too, because you don't want to look like a jerk. And, you know, these are competitors. But twice in my career, I've stood up and interrupted a speaker because they were going to get people killed. And actually, one time, John Ball and I were together watching someone present an EHAP training, and they said something that was a violation of a federal standard. The ANSI standard was going to get somebody killed. And I felt kind of bad for doing it, but I'm like, I have a conscience. We have to do it. So John Ball and I jumped up like, actually, no, just delete that last thing he said. Don't do that. That's going to kill somebody.
It comes from a place. It comes from a place of love, and it comes from a place of that is your passion. That's also, I mean, if there are two experts on the topic, regardless of who's in the room, it's probably you and John Ball. I mean, really.
Maybe on that topic, but you kind of hit a nerve there, and I wasn't necessarily going to go this way. But if you guys will permit me, and feel free to edit this out if you want, but I'll give you my elevator speech of why I do what I do. And it's a promise to a mother. And it was the first fatality I dealt with and had to deal with go to the site. The body was still there. Had to deal with that. Had to deal with the medical examiner, had to deal with OSHA, deal with the crew. And then I had to go meet his family. And his mother kept saying, why can't he come home? They just want him to come home. And she grabbed me and hugged me. And when I walked out, there were tears drying in my chest. And she grabbed my arm and she said, you need to promise me they're going to make sure this doesn't happen to somebody else's mother. I failed 32 times since that. That's what drives me. And so when I see somebody say something, I don't care if that person thinks I'm a jerk, but if somebody takes that information and doesn't get hurt, then I've done my job. And that's been my North Star for 20 something years. And I've changed jobs and careers because I couldn't fulfill that promise anymore. But ultimately, it's that I made a promise to this woman all those years ago.
What a call in. Oh.
You know, but there is a saying in the industry that is exactly what you said, Tim. If you see it, say it. You know, and there's cowboys out there that are going to be rogue and they're going to do what they want. And you're right. It comes down to, I was at the Great Lakes Vegetation Management last week, and I asked one question to the motivational speaker. And the question was, is that when you're hiring, and you've hired a lot of people, Tim, do you put, and he's a sports nut. So his whole conference or his whole presentation was on like team building and used a lot of sports analogies. So I said, do you put the trade clause in when you hire them? Do you put that clause in that, hey, if you F up X amount of times, you will not be in this industry? And I think we need to be a little stronger, because we are in an industry where it happens. So.
Well, that's it.
Thank you for being there to say it.
No, this could be another 8-hour talk on that. One on the front side, what I always try to do is sort of scare people away, especially in safety. One of them is the travel piece, because what we do, you need to live on the road. But the other is I ask a two-part question, and I say, as a safety professional, in this industry, you're likely to deal with a serious incident or fatality. First part of the question, how do you deal with that emotionally, psychologically, ethically, morally? I said, then the harder question, how do you get back up the next day and come and do it again? And I've had people walk out of interviews because they thought, I can't do it. And that's okay. This is, not everyone wants to do this job, and not everyone can do this job. So yeah, you need to be prepared for that conversation.
Yeah, so you're truly right.
So Tim, as we're wrapping up today's conversation, if you're thinking, and I know we've covered a lot of content on just a message or a key point that you could get out to the masses, a couple hundred thousand people that listen to these episodes, who knows what it is, what would that message be to the listener?
I'm going to quote somebody. I think Dr. Kim Coder. If you want to be successful, he talked to students, 20 years ago, and he talked for an hour and 58 minutes. I don't remember what he said. Sorry, Kim, but the last 2 minutes he said, have a mentor and be a mentor. And I've been successful because of that. I don't know, one of the questions you normally ask is sort of who is the mentor, but Alex Shigo, Kim Coder, Ken Palmer, John Ball, Todd Conklin, Ivan Papaliti, Georgina Poole. I've been very fortunate to have people like that in my life. And the list goes on and on, so apologize for all the people I've forgotten. But whether it's in this industry or another, if you have good mentors, you will become better. You'll get the right culture. And at some point, you start shifting and you become a mentor. People start looking to you and like, hey, I heard Corey's podcast. He knows something. I want to learn from him. So I think that's probably the most simple thing to be successful is have a mentor and be a mentor.
I love it. Tim, thank you so much. And again, thank you for, you made the comment that, sometimes you just got to say it. Thanks for saying it and being there and being the man that would do it. And you did the ones that you listed off. And I know that you're right. There are hundreds more big shoulders that we stand on in this industry, because I'm a big believer in the history of the industry and what they've done. Great people. And you're right. Tori, I think you and I have talked about this in previous podcasts. Put someone under your wing. Hopefully that will lead to them putting someone under their wing one day. And you build that culture by doing that.
Well, and you never know. It's going to force you to grow as an individual, the company or the organization you're with. And then what's more important is those lives that Tim's out there saving. A lot of these other people are out there really just leaving a positive impact on. So, Tim, Joe, my pleasure. Great conversation tonight. And we're going to have to do this again, a little elaborated version of this next time.
Yeah, thank you both for the opportunity. And any of the topics we talked to, we could talk for a couple hours. I appreciate this. It's an honor to be on the podcast. And Joe, I'll see you next week.
Yes, sir.
Hey, great topic today.
Yes, and lots of good information.
Yeah, probably one of our best yet.
If you enjoyed the podcast or have topics you would like to discuss, please send them to discoveringforestry@gmail.com. And please hit the subscribe button and tell a friend.
Thanks, guys, for tuning in. Until next time, I'm Joe.
And I'm Corey.
Signing out.